This is the takeaway for Friday, October 20th, 2017.
This is the takeaway. I'm Todd Zwillick. We're happy to have you with us on this Friday. Congressional investigators are scrutinizing how people working for the Russian government used Facebook and Google to change Americans' views during the 2016 election. At its heart, this is a story about transparency and democracy.
I care deeply about the democratic process and protecting its integrity.
Facebook CEO Mark Zuckerberg back in September.
Facebook's mission is all about giving people a voice and bringing people closer together. Those are democratic values, and we're proud of them. I don't want anyone to use our tools to undermine democracy. That's not what we stand for.
Well, Mark Zuckerberg says there that Facebook is all about bringing people together, but investigators now know that Russians used Facebook to drive people apart. They say a Russian company paid for roughly $100,000 worth of political ads that ran on Facebook before the 2016 election. Google is also being asked to turn over political ads that investigators say Russians bought on its service. There are all kinds of ads on Facebook and Google, but here's the thing. Political ads on internet platforms are mostly exempt from the kind of disclosure rules that govern the political ads you see on TV or in print. And lawmakers are now reacting. Three senators, including Republican John McCain of Arizona, have a new bill. It says ads on the internet basically have to play by the same rules as political ads elsewhere. Minnesota Democratic Senator Amy Klobuchar is one of the sponsors.
I just cannot justify, as a U.S. senator, that you would apply one set of laws to one media outlet, to TV, radio, and print, and then not apply it to another.
Ann Ravel is a former chair of the Federal Election Commission. She's a professor at Berkeley Law and someone who's in favor of new disclosure rules for political ads on the internet.
It's really important for internets to have disclosures and disclaimers because most of the political advertising now is moving to the internet. And people have a right to know who's behind campaigns. And even more so, one of the reasons they have to know is to determine whether there is corruption involved. That's the whole purpose, as well as information about who to vote for.
Well, you know, Facebook and Google say and have said in the past that it's difficult to tell commercial ads from political ones in a lot of cases. A lot of ads aren't nakedly political. They don't say vote for X or vote against Y. And that they're running so many ads on their sites that it would just be a gigantic challenge to police every single ad. These things are auto-generated in some ways. What do you think of that argument?
Well, I don't think anybody is asking Facebook to police the ads. All that is required is for them to keep them in some sort of repository and to produce them. And someone else can determine whether they're political or not. No one's asking Facebook to be the enforcer.
Well, Facebook has also warned, they told the FEC back in 2011, that a regime like this would stifle innovation, meaning the internet is an open, unregulated place. That's what promotes commerce on the internet. And that regulation of speech like this would just slow all of that down.
Nobody wants to stifle innovation, but what Facebook is doing here is undermining our democracy, and that's what we've seen in the 2016 election. So it's more important for them to produce this information than the people whose job it is to look to see whether it is violative of the law or not can take that action.
But Anne, if there were, let's say, similar disclosure and disclaimer rules on the internet as there are for TV, and we've seen them when you see a political ad, it has paid for by Americans for the American way at the bottom, or it says, I'm Joe Smith and I approve this message. What would prevent, say, Russians or Americans working with Russians in this case to simply start a group called Americans for Freedom and Flags and then fund ads that way? The disclosure would tell you who bought the ad, but it wouldn't tell you anything about who funded the group who bought the ad.
Well, that's exactly right. And that happens today on the internet and in other places. That's what dark money is. But at least if there is a regime in place that requires not just these disclaimers, but some kind of disclosure so that Facebook or Google or any of the other platforms have to provide who is purchasing the ad. Then it's up to the enforcers to look to find out what the original source was, and that information can be given to the public.
What kind of company is Facebook? What kind of company is Google? They say they're social media platforms that say, we're not a media company, we're not CNN, and we're not your local television station, we're something different. What do you think they are?
I'm not sure that I would necessarily define them as a media company, but what they have done is monetized electoral advertising. They get a lot of money from the bots that they sell and other ways of promulgating ads. They get money from telling people how to micro-target to certain groups. So because of that, they're not just a company that tries to get people from all over the world to communicate with their families. They're a company that is making a lot of money off of providing, in this case, possibly propaganda or providing actual election ads.
Ann Ravel, thank you for joining us and giving us your views.
Thank you.
Ann Ravel is a former chair of the Federal Election Commission, and she's a professor at Berkeley Law. Google is one internet giant that can have a big influence on the information Americans get in their democracy. Well, it's becoming increasingly clear that the company's domination of internet search is even influencing the opioid epidemic.
Google's internal statistics show that 61% of addicts or their parents are using the internet to find help for addiction treatment. And the vast majority of those people turn to Google. And that gives Google this tremendous power.
As part of our ongoing coverage of opioids in America, we turn to David Dayan, contributor at The Intercept. He's been writing about how Google may actually be making it harder for people in crisis to find the addiction treatment they need.
If you do any Google searches at all, you know that these days, some of the top searches at the top of the list when you type something in are ads. They have that little green box that say ad next to them. And that was true for rehab centers and facilities treating opioid addiction until about last month. There was an expose in a news outlet called The Verge about how the companies that were bidding high for these ads were somewhat shady. They were steering patients into treatment they didn't really need or wasn't right for them. And so Google made this snap decision. They said that they were canceling all ads for rehab facilities. And so everything that was left was this organic search. And the idea was, with the best of intentions, if there was a shadiness going on with the ads, that, you know, they would just take those off and move to organic search. The problem is that even the organic search can be gamed by large conglomerates who use their clout and their buying power, really, to get into the top of these search requests and, once again, use call centers to steer patients towards facilities that they own that might not be right for them.
Google, as a model, is always vulnerable to scammers pushing their ads high. It could happen with bakeries. It could happen with people who sell tires. But this is a crisis, the opioid problem in America, and Google decided they didn't want to have business as usual here.
That's right. You know, any move that Google makes is going to preference one type of facility over the other. And the way it's done with the organic search is there are these large directories that have been around, in some cases, for many years, like rehabs.com. And in 2015, a conglomerate that owns a bunch of treatment centers bought rehabs.com, and they effectively bought a high search ranking in these Google searches, because if you type in rehabs near me, one of the top searches is going to be that rehabs.com, but all of the calls end up going to these call centers that are pushing you towards this specific conglomerate's facilities. It was described to me as like if Consumer Reports was owned by Toyota. So we had one of our sources call one of these numbers. He made up sort of a scenario, said he was looking for treatment in Wisconsin for his father, and he called a number that was attached to a listing of top 10 treatment centers in Wisconsin. And throughout this 20-minute call, which is on our website, it's at the story, the call center operator kept saying, no, you don't want to go to Wisconsin. You want this treatment center in Massachusetts that's really good.
There's one place I'm thinking of that would be absolutely perfect for him. The place that I'm thinking about, we would need to fly him to Massachusetts. Most of the time when you go to rehab like that, like going close to home is not the best idea, because it's more of a commitment. Like when you get on an airplane and you show up, you know, it's more of a commitment. It's more serious. You're going to spend more, you know, more of your energy into it if you do make a commitment.
Of course, that was one of the four treatment centers that this conglomerate actually owns. So, you know, you really get a sense of how these call centers are really steering patients away from even things that they were looking up to begin with.
What about legitimate treatment centers? Have they tried to buy ad space to push their ads higher, or does that just wind up in a Google arms race?
Right. I mean, now the situation is that there are no ads. So Google dropped all the ads. So all of these more legitimate or smaller treatment centers, it's not that the large conglomerates are necessarily illegitimate. It's that they might not be right for the particular patient. And, you know, the smaller competitors really have no ability to compete. They don't have the ability to buy ads. The search rankings are based on, you know, the Google secret sauce, the algorithm. And it seems like the larger players in this space have figured out a way to get on top of that. And then in the business listings, which you would think would be completely neutral, where it's just a map and you see the facilities near you, certain players have figured out how to target themselves to a street corner or a P.O. box, and suddenly they look local, but they're actually, you know, in Florida or in Massachusetts or wherever. And then there are scams where the business listing can have its number changed by people who are not affiliated with that business, rerouting those calls to these call centers.
It seems like you could come up with a list of any other major problem that people would be vulnerable to here if they were using Google as the lens to find help. Some kind of psychiatric disorder, suicide hotline. I mean, you can dream up a lot of scenarios where this exact thing might be really dangerous.
Absolutely. And I think that's sort of the larger frame of this problem. Google is operating almost as a private government. You know, they have this tremendous power to sort of shape policy on how people can access treatment. And they shouldn't be put in that situation. I mean, they shouldn't have that kind of power. And, you know, there are certainly ways that they could offload that. The Substance Abuse and Mental Health Services Administration runs their own directory, which is very neutral information of what's in your area and a description of it and a place to get more details so you can do that work of figuring out what's right for you. That site does not come up at the top of these Google searches, and maybe it should.
Can Google choose to take that government list, that SAMHSA list of places in your area, and just stick it at the top of every search and make that be it?
That's certainly a possibility open to them. When we contacted Google, they did not, you know, really make any statement as to what they're going to do here, whether they'll bring back ads or whether they will do some modification to the search. But once again, I think the larger problem here is that people seem like they only have this one choice of Google when they're looking for treatment. And I think we need to figure out ways to improve that.
David Dayan, writing in The Intercept. Thank you.
Thank you.
Let's go to Brownsville, Texas now, where a court case is challenging the federal government's right to deny access to abortion. Federal authorities are holding a 17-year-old girl from Central America in immigration detention. Jane Doe, as she's come to be known, is 15 weeks pregnant and wants an abortion. But the government is denying her access to that abortion, and that's brought a lawsuit from the ACLU. On Wednesday, the D.C. Court of Appeals ordered the Trump administration to allow the teenager access to the procedure. But on Thursday, the administration appealed, and the court held up that decision. The case is raising questions about whether an undocumented immigrant like Jane Doe has a right to a procedure that the Supreme Court has said is legal. Tina Vasquez is an immigration reporter for Rewire News. She's been following the story, and she joins me now. Tina, welcome to The Takeaway.
Hi, Todd. Thank you for having me.
Tina, walk us through the case that the ACLU has filed on behalf of Jane Doe, 17 years old.
So Jane Doe is in a shelter that's overseen by the Office of Refugee Resettlement, and that's sort of the agency that handles unaccompanied immigrant minors like Jane Doe who are migrating from Central America and hoping to reunite with family in the United States. So she has been trying to access an abortion since September 11th and received the judicial bypass that's required by the state of Texas. If you don't want to get permission or you can't get permission from your parents to access abortion, you have to go to court. She successfully received that, but ever since then, since September 11th, she's been blocked by the Office of Refugee Resettlement from being able to access abortion, and that means that they haven't allowed her to go to the clinic, and that means that they haven't transported her. They won't allow her guardian to transport her. Attorneys that I've spoken to have essentially said that she's being held hostage by the Office of Refugee Resettlement, and she's 15 weeks pregnant now, and the fear is that they're purposefully holding her as long as possible so that she gets to the 20-week mark and can't access abortion at all.
What's the Trump administration's position here?
I think there's two stances being taken. One is that Roe v. Wade doesn't apply to undocumented immigrants because undocumented immigrants don't have constitutional rights. And also Scott Lloyd, who's the director of Office of Refugee Resettlement, is basically taking the stance that he is the foster parent of unaccompanied immigrant minors that are in the care of the Office of Refugee Resettlement. And so he's essentially acting as her parent. And if he doesn't want to let her get an abortion, then he's within his rights to do that.
Well, let's talk about that first position that Jane Doe is an undocumented immigrant and therefore doesn't have constitutional rights, because the federal judge that last ruled on this week said exactly the opposite. She says Jane Doe does have constitutional rights. Roe v. Wade means that abortion is legal. Why isn't that enough to guarantee Jane Doe an access to the procedure? It's legal. The court says it has to be legal. Why can't she get it?
I think it's the Trump administration's stance that undocumented immigrants don't have constitutional rights and the administration certainly treats them as if they don't have many rights. A lot of the things that we're seeing under the Trump administration questions whether or not the children of undocumented parents even should have citizenship. And so I think it's just their general stance that none of the things that apply to American citizens should apply to undocumented immigrants. And you see time and time again instances in which they are not treated as if they have rights. And I think this is just another example of that and like a horrible overstep, because she's done everything that she needs to do to access abortion in the state of Texas, which already places a lot of hurdles in place for a young person trying to get an abortion. And her immigration status now is just another complicated layer that's preventing her from accessing this thing that she has a right to do.
Well, what have courts said in the past then about the constitutional rights of undocumented immigrants? Abortion aside, surely they must have ruled on this issue in other areas of life.
I mean, yeah, there are court cases as to whether or not undocumented children deserve or should access K-12 education. They do, but you have states like Florida that are trying to block undocumented immigrant children from accessing public education. There are just all kinds of instances in which, you know, in North Carolina, where I live until very recently, undocumented immigrants could not enter higher education. They couldn't even go to community colleges. Just very basic things that maybe we don't consider really, or that we take for granted, undocumented immigrants have been blocked from, or there have been really huge hurdles put in place for them to access just sort of basic things like medical care, like access to education.
Medical care and access to education, but have courts ruled in the past in other areas that don't necessarily involve abortion that undocumented immigrants do indeed have constitutional rights when they're here?
I mean, there's a lot going on with that. Like, for example, whether or not we can hold undocumented immigrants indefinitely in prison, in detention centers, whether or not they deserve a bail hearing, you know, or a bond hearing. When you're an American citizen, you usually get a bond hearing upon being arrested and charged within 48 hours. There are instances of undocumented immigrants being held in detention centers for years without receiving a bond hearing. And so right now, or recently, the Supreme Court heard Jennings versus Rodriguez, which will determine whether or not we can hold undocumented immigrants in detention centers, which are prisons, indefinitely without having a bond hearing. It's not that undocumented immigrants haven't been in the United States for a long time, but I feel like the United States is sort of feeling out whether or not they have constitutional protections.
Bettina, is there a broader principle that the Trump administration is trying out here? Are they hoping for a precedent of some kind that will extend beyond just this one case?
If people are having trouble understanding why the government is funneling so many resources or fixating on this particular teen, I think it's because her case will have larger implications for young people who are in shelters. I think if Scott Lloyd, the director of the Office of Refugee Resettlement, can basically veto her judicial bypass, he can do that to any teenager in custody. And like Jane's Due Process told me, that's the organization in Texas that's helping with Jane Doe's case, that if Scott Lloyd can veto a judicial bypass, so can a father or a husband or a governor or any authority figure. So it has larger implications, not just for undocumented immigrants, but for women and people seeking abortion in general.
Atina, how long before we're going to have a final decision in this case?
The court is hearing arguments today, and there should be we should know by the end of the day.
Tina Vasquez, immigration reporter for Rewire News. Thank you.
Thank you.
Japanese Prime Minister Shinzo Abe has a little more than a year left in his term, but on Sunday, he surprised everyone in Japan by calling a snap election. That leaves just 2 weeks to campaign. Doesn't that sound nice? Well, critics accuse Abe of using this quick election to avoid scrutiny of scandals in the economy. And it appears right now that the strategy might be working. Tobias Harris is an analyst at the political risk advisory firm Teneo Intelligence. He's also an economy, trade, and business fellow at Sasakawa USA.
Abe saw a moment of opportunity where after a summer in which he saw his poll numbers plummet, they started to creep back up. And at the same time, the opposition Democratic Party was struggling more than it has in years. And he saw an opportunity to lock in a new mandate.
Mm. Well, how is Abe doing on the big issues, like, let's say, the economy in Japan?
In terms of just the headline numbers, I mean, Japan's economy is growing steadily. It's actually enjoying its longest streak of growth in 11 years. Unemployment is below 3% and has been for some time. The labor market's very tight. He's also, I think, and we can talk maybe separately about the question of North Korea, but I think his foreign policy, to the extent that he's made Japan more visible on the world stage during his 5 years in office, I think there's a certain amount of appreciation on the Japanese people for that.
Let's talk about North Korea, because North Korean missile launches, of course, repeatedly go over Japanese territory. There have been security drills complete with air sirens. How important an issue is that for voters now?
There's been a surprising change where usually the top 2 to 3 issues are Social Security and pensions, economic growth and jobs. And there has been a difference this time around where number 2 has actually been foreign policy. It's a good deal behind in second place, but it's been much higher on the list of voters' priorities than usual. And that probably does reflect North Korea.
Abe has pledged in the past to try to amend the parts of the Japanese Constitution, making it a pacifist nation, and instead to rebuild its military. This has been a key part of Japan's post-World War II identity. Is he serious about doing that? And what would that mean to Japan's relationship with its neighbors?
Even without revising the Constitution, he's already done quite a bit since taking power again in 2012. He's raised defense spending every year since he came back into office. Japan's self-defense forces are investing in new technologies. They've made changes to Japan's ability to cooperate with the U.S., what's so-called collective self-defense. So now you have the self-defense forces in a position where they can start training and preparing to cooperate with the U.S. military in new ways. So that's already happened.
Well, let's talk about one of Abe's challengers, Tokyo Governor Yuriko Koike. Tell me about her.
Although Koike and the Party of Hope received much of the media attention at the start of the campaign, what's actually happened is that a new party called the Constitutional Democratic Party has actually sparked much more interest from voters who have been longing for a party that would be more willing to oppose Abe from the left. The problem is they're not running enough candidates, so they can't really threaten to take power, but they've actually risen in the polls and might actually beat out the Party of Hope to be Japan's second largest party.
So, Tobias, let me ask you before we let you go, a 12-day campaign, you know, mercifully short, especially by American standards. What are national elections like in Japan? Would we recognize them as Americans?
It tends to be much more retail. There's not as much emphasis on TV and ad buys and broadcast media. I mean, obviously, it's part of the campaign, but there is a lot of emphasis on candidates showing up, holding events, giving speeches, talking to voters, you know, pounding the pavement, handing out flyers, putting up posters. I mean, it's much more low tech. And in fact, until a couple of years ago, Japanese election law basically banned the use of websites and Twitter and social media during the campaign period.
We have seen Russian interference in elections from the United States to France, all across Europe, Germany, Ukraine, other places. Is anyone in Japan worried that Russian intelligence operations might push fake news?
There were some lots of rumors that seemed to spread that had no basis, and there was some talk about fake news. But I don't think, you know, certainly no one was attributing that, you know, to a foreign intelligence operation. And the other thing about Japanese elections is that they do not do electronic voting machines. They go into the voting booth, they write down the name of the candidate, and they write down the name of the party on a piece of paper. And that's how the votes are recorded and how they're tallied. So pretty hard to hack that.
Tobias Harris of Teneo Intelligence, thanks so much.
Thank you for having me on.
This is The Takeaway. I'm Todd Zwillick. Defense Secretary James Mattis said Thursday that an investigation is underway into the deaths of four U.S. military personnel in Niger 2 weeks ago. But he said the Pentagon still doesn't have all the answers.
War is war, and these terrorists are conducting war on innocent people of all religions. And I would just tell you that in the this specific case, contact was considered unlikely. But there's a reason we have U.S. Army soldiers there and not the Peace Corps, because we carry guns.
Defense Secretary James Mattis there. Well, that raises the question of how this attack happened and what the role of the U.S. military is in Niger. Dan Lamothe is national security writer for The Washington Post. He joins me now with the latest. Dan, welcome to The Takeaway.
Yes, thanks for having me today.
Well, Dan, there's been a lot of mystery around the circumstances of the attack that resulted in four U.S. service members getting killed. What do we know so far?
This was what appeared to be routine patrol for a group that included some Green Beret Special Forces soldiers and some regular conventional U.S. troops that were with them. They were ambushed by what appears to be a much larger force that had heavy weapons and other things that would have been, you know, a serious threat. These Americans were traveling in basically regular pickup trucks, what they call in the military thin skin vehicles. So not much in the way of armor. And the patrol was apparently pretty quickly cut in half. And Sergeant Johnson here, the individual that's sort of at the center of this conversation about President Trump, was separated from the rest of his unit and left in the field for basically almost 2 days.
It does appear, even though we don't know a lot about the circumstances here, that these U.S. forces were caught off guard.
Yes, I think that's certainly fair. We've heard at the Pentagon that the Americans had been in and out of this particular area of Niger more than 24 times over the previous 6 months, and this was not expected to be any kind of combat patrol or combat situation.
Well, let's take a step back. What are American personnel doing in Niger? How big is the U.S. presence there, and what's the mission?
The mission is relatively small. There are a undefined and probably evolving number of American troops there. It's primarily a Green Beret mission, but not entirely. It is what they call foreign internal defense. Basically, they are partnering with the Niger troops to try and make them better. So it's everything from training them how to shoot better, to plan better, to preparing for major operations. But the idea is that this should not be a combat situation for the American troops. This is basically something they do in many, many countries. And this is something we just never hear about, but is ongoing all the time. It was not a surprise to me covering the Pentagon that we had people there. It was just a surprise the way this went down.
Meanwhile, the commander-in-chief is involved in a very public argument about what he may or may not have said to the parents of Sergeant LaDavid Johnson. Dan, is America getting the full story on how these young men got killed while this argument goes on cable news all day long?
I don't think we are getting the full story at this point. I don't think we're getting even close to the full story at this point. That is something that I think is incumbent on the media to continue to ask about, incumbent on Congress to continue asking about. The military has launched a rather robust investigation. So we should at some point get to a point where we've got witness testimony and things of that sort to get out. So there will be a better understanding even from the ground level of what happened. But we are probably still a good long way away from that.
All right, Dan, thanks for joining us and for giving us an update.
Sure. Thank you.
Dan Lamoth, national security writer for The Washington Post. We want to talk now about what happens when law enforcement officers run up against the law themselves. One former officer turned researcher is building a public database that tracks how often police get arrested for misconduct on the job, but also for alleged lawbreaking in their off-duty lives. What started as a grad school project has now become a 13-year-long study called Police Integrity Lost. Phil Stinson has documented over 8,000 arrests involving more than 6,500 officers across the country from 2005 to 2012. He hopes the research will tell us about police misconduct, the pressures in police officers' lives, and how cops respond when police themselves get in trouble.
We found a lot of things. First of all, it's not that uncommon that police officers get in trouble. Police officers get arrested across the country literally every day of the year across the United States, where a police officer not only gets arrested, but there's an article or more than one article in the local newspapers about the alleged crimes.
So what kind of patterns are you seeing in these arrests?
One thing that we found is that prior research would suggest that officers who get in trouble are going to do so very early in their career, and then they're either going to wash out or they're going to calm down and ride it out for the rest of their career. What we're finding is something different, that more than 15% of the arrest cases where an officer is arrested is within 3 years of retirement eligibility. It's on the back end of an officer's career. And there's something about the pre-retirement stage, the lack of retirement planning, that needs to be looked at much more closely. And we see all sorts of crime. It's not just one type of crime, but we're seeing a lot of things where law enforcement officers are really sort of unraveling very late in their career. So that's a concern to us. We've also seen different types of patterns over time. Just as we would see with the general population in the opioid crisis, we see officers getting arrested for different prescribed pill problems and heroin.
How big of an issue is violence?
It's a huge issue. I think when we look back at all the cases, the 8,000 or so cases we have coded in our database from the 8-year period, 2005 through 2012, more than half of the crimes for which officers are arrested for are violence-related offenses. And this includes not only crimes that are committed on duty, but also crimes where officers are arrested for things that happened off-duty. And that's a big problem as well. And we include that, the off-duty crimes, because it's not so simple with a police officer simply being able to turn it off when they go home at night. They still remain a police officer, and some of them are really fired up when they get home.
So tease apart these two things for me, because that's interesting. Are you looking primarily at crimes that officers are arrested for related to being police officers, something on duty or maybe something involving corruption because they're a cop, or just arrests from everyday life not associated with being a cop, but it happens to be a police officer who gets arrested?
Well, Todd, the problem is there's no bright line distinction. It's very hard to say that the crimes committed by police officers while off duty are not police crime, that they're not somehow related to their job as a police officer. For example, drunk driving. In the past, police officers have been exempt from law enforcement. Seems like a strange thing that law enforcement is exempt from law enforcement. And yet we have well over 1,000 cases where officers during that time period were arrested for drunk driving. About 10% of those cases are actually on duty driving police cars, but the rest of them are off duty. And there's something about those cases that led the officer to get arrested. Why were they not given that exemption? Why were they not extended that professional courtesy? And it's usually because of things like traffic accidents or slamming a car into a building or being involved in a hit and run while drunk. Those types of factors seem to come into play with the off duty drunk driving cases. We have a lot of sex crimes that officers are arrested for off duty. The concerning thing to us as researchers about those are that more than half of those cases involve a victim who's under the age of 18 and some very, very young victims. So that's something that we're still researching and looking into that. Crimes of violence off duty. Officer involved domestic violence is a huge problem. And we have literally many hundreds of cases where officers are arrested for assault cases arising out of some sort of a domestic violence situation. And one of the reasons why that's a big problem is that under the Lautenberg Amendment to the Federal Gun Control Act of 1968, someone who's convicted of a qualifying misdemeanor crime of domestic violence cannot carry a gun, cannot own a gun, cannot carry ammunition. So you can't work as a police officer if you have a misdemeanor record for if you've been convicted for simple assault in a domestic situation.
So, Phil Stinson, it sounds like you have a large and growing database of sort of raw numbers here when it comes to police officers and getting arrested. Does it tell you anything about how cops might be different from everybody else? I mean, people get arrested all the time for lots of bad things. They're not always convicted. Do you know yet how cops are different from the rest of us?
You know, it's a hard question to answer. As a criminologist, I'd like to be able to give you some sort of theoretical answer. But in many regards, I think it's frankly because officers think they can get away with it. When I started this research as a graduate student, one of the things that I was really interested in and am still interested in today, 13 years later, are the crimes that law enforcement officers commit for which they're not arrested. And that's the great dark figure. That's the great hidden aspect of police crime. We don't have any way of measuring that. There's no way that you can collect data on something when somebody actually isn't arrested. And especially with the police subculture, it's just not something that can be studied very easily at all.
So as you collect all this data, Phil Stinson, a lot of it will have to be analyzed as the database grows. What's the biggest unanswered question in your mind about what might be hiding in your numbers?
The purpose of the research is to really study police integrity, learn more about it, and to improve policing. And sometimes people think that my work is in some way anti-policing, and I don't look at it that way at all. We really want to figure out ways that we can improve policing. We've got to figure out that a way to get that back to the agencies, to get policymakers thinking about this, to get police executives, administrators, police chiefs, supervisors, thinking about ways that they can take this information that we've aggregated in a way that nobody else has and improve their local agencies and really improve the quality of life of police officers and their families. That's an important thing.
Phil Stinson is Associate Professor of Criminal Justice at Bowling Green State University in Ohio, a former cop himself in New Hampshire. Phil Stinson, thanks for being with us.
My pleasure.
Check, please.
Check, please.
Check, please.
Check, please.
Can I get the check here, please?
Check, please.
Can we get the check, please?
Check, please.
Check, please.
Check, please.
Check, please. Oh, no. Not again.
Check, please.
Can you get the check, please?
Come on. The man wants his check.
Oh, my God. That's so annoying. When people do this, it's like, check, please.
You know who never gets the check when you're out to lunch? Rafer Guzman, film critic for Newsday.
Come
and
on.
For us here at The Takeaway.
I'll pick up the check.
You will, actually. I'm joking. Of course you'd get the check. You'd do that. You're a high-paid movie critic.
That's
of course.
Right.
You'd
That's
love to
right.
do that. We are going to talk about a new film, Only the Brave. This is one of the films we're going to talk about. I bring up Only the Brave because we've got some trivia for you from that movie. This is a movie about firefighters protecting their town from a wildfire, a bit of historical fiction. It's got Jeff Bridges and Josh Brolin. So I give you some Josh Brolin trivia here. Don't answer now. And if you know it, listeners, do hit me up on Twitter at Todd Zwillick. You can try to beat Rafer to the punch here. I give you young Josh Brolin. Name this film.
You guys, this map is old news. Everybody and their grandfather went looking for that when our parents were our age. I mean, haven't you ever heard of that guy? What's his name? The pirate guy. One-Eyed Willie.
Name that film. If you know it, hit me on Twitter. Rafer is looking, he's squinting, he's searching for it. We'll see if he gets it by the end here. But let's talk about Only the Brave, which does star Josh Brolin, also Jeff Bridges, Miles Teller. This is based on the true story of the Granite Mountain Hotshots, elite firefighters protecting their town from a wildfire.
Now, I'm not going to sugarcoat it. This first season as Hotshots is going to be tough. You're going to be working harder, going longer. So it's important that this Granite Mountain family pulls together, because we can't do this without your support.
Josh Brolin throwing the firefighters into the fray.
That's right. As you said, real story about this firefighting crew protecting the town of Prescott, Arizona. Josh Brolin plays the superintendent. This is one of those movies that I like to call a proxy war movie. It feels like a war movie, seems like a war movie. Mm. The guys sort of interact and seem like soldiers, but they're not quite. A little bit like Deepwater Horizon
Indeed.
Or something like The Finest Hours, things like that. But so you get a lot of sort of Top Gun style machismo here, a lot of, you know, macho interaction. person, but I do think the movie works pretty well. And Josh Brolin, who's great as the superintendent, he's wonderful. Miles Teller, who plays a new recruit, is in this movie. He's great as well. I think maybe I'm willing to overlook some of the hokier Hollywood moments of this film because of the Santa Rosa fires that have been going on. It does kind of make you feel for the firefighters and what they're doing and what they're sacrificing.
But this is the moment as well, I mean, at the box office.
Yeah, right. Yeah. I mean, you know, so it's possible that this could sort of help give this movie a bit of a boost.
Yeah.
But I think it works well. Pretty solid, pretty intense, good entertainment.
Let's go to The Snowman now. This is a new Michael Fassbender film, and whenever he's in something, I automatically start to get my ticket wallet out.
Because, me too.
Yeah, when Michael Fassbender appears in a film, he's in this with Rebecca Ferguson. This is a detective movie, a detective mystery about the disappearance of a young woman.
I know how much you want this, but you can't force the pieces to fit.
Do you actually think he killed them?
I don't know. I don't think either of us do for sure.
Michael Fassbender earned the ticket money for me that I think he's probably going to get anyway.
I think he's very good in this film, or at least as good as he can be given the material. I was hoping for something really good. You know, who doesn't love a serial killer noir film with
love
the detective
it.
Chasing the guy
That's
down,
my thing,
right?
Yeah.
The clues, you know, the snowman outside the victim's home. But somehow this is just one of those movies where you're smarter than everybody else in the film, and that's always a bummer. There's a scene in this film where Michael Fassbender forgets where his gun is, but we remember. We remember who has the gun. Why can't he? It's one of those movies. I was really disappointed in this. I had high hopes.
Yeah, this will leave you yelling at the screen. The gun is behind the washing
right.
machine.
The guy
don't you
still
remember?
Has the gun. Yeah, exactly.
And that can be an unbelievably frustrating thing when you want the characters of the movie to lead you here. You know, they're supposed to know more than you.
You're not supposed to figure it out before they do.
Let's see if you can figure out trivia, Rafer. I want to bring you back to this because we were talking about Josh Brolin, who is starring in the new Wildfire movie, Only the Brave.
Yep.
I played you young Josh Brolin. Here he is.
You guys, this map is old news. Everybody and their grandfather went looking for that when our parents were our age. I mean, haven't you ever heard of that guy? What's his name? The pirate guy. One-Eyed Willie.
Rafer, Twitter is lighting up with the answer. There are a lot of people who got this. I hope you know it.
Is that the Goonies?
Ah, there he is. Rafer, good for you. We got the Goonies. And I'll give some credit to Ed's Night Owl on Twitter as well, who was the first listener to chime in. While your eyes were still squinting, Carrie, otherwise known as Ed's Night Owl, hit me up on Twitter with the right answer. Rafer Guzman, film critic for Newsday. Thanks so much for being here.
Thanks, Dodd.
All right, that's all for us today. You can call us at 877-8-MY-TAKE, and you can always tweet us at The Takeaway. Thanks so much for listening. Have a great weekend. I'm Todd Zwillick. This is The Takeaway.